each side felt that their way, their approach was best. And it was a junior product manager who piped up and said, we're fighting over turf, right? We're fighting over who does it best. We need to step back and think, what's best for the customer? How do we get to the solution that's best for the customer? And when you keep your customer as your North Star and work back from what's really best for them, you can let go of whose approach is best. It allows you to just see what you're fighting for.
Welcome to the Connected Leadership Podcast, hosted by Andy Lapata, the show where Andy and his guests explore the many ways in which relationships impact business decisions, make leaders' jobs easier, and help you to progress your career.
Hello, and welcome to the Connected Leadership Podcast. I'm Andy Lapata. Thank you very much for joining me. My guest today is someone who advises senior executives and their organizations on the unexpected people challenges of mergers and acquisitions. She's got a background in advertising, marketing, and comms with brands such as Cadbury, Schweppes, Unilever, and Nestle, working with them through big mergers and the growth of those companies. And then she moved into C-suite roles at companies like Nokia, where she led marketing teams, helping them navigate three separate multi-billion merger and acquisition deals. She's the author of the satirical book, Now What? A Survivor's Guide for Thriving Through Mergers and Acquisitions. And she's written for publications like Harvard Business Review, Fast Company, and Forbes. And she's known as the M&A Whisperer. Jennifer Fondrevet, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Andy. You make me sound fabulous.
Well, that's my job in the intro. Your job is to carry on doing that over the rest of the podcast.
I have to keep up with the intro.
Absolutely. I've done my bit. Now, we connected recently because of mutual connections. And really, you just reached out to me on LinkedIn. But when I looked at what you do and I looked at your background, I thought that you'd make a great guest on the Connected Leadership Podcast, because, you know, the focus of the podcast is looking at the role of professional relationships and strong relationships, connectivity, in making great leaders. And one of the issues where relationships get strained to the nth degree is in the process of a merger or acquisition. You know, I've spoken over the years at conferences at various points during the process, before, when all the rumors are around, during the process, post a merger or acquisition. And I've seen the impact that the uncertainty and change can have on morale, the impact on teams working together, the growth of silo mentalities, and more. So I'm very aware of the importance of strong relationships and the challenges towards that throughout the various stages of the process. So let's start. You've experienced, I mentioned in the introduction, you've experienced three huge mergers or acquisitions firsthand. You've worked with clients that have been through it as well in your previous roles. What are the major issues you've experienced, particularly with the way people are impacted by these changes?
Well, I'm so glad first that you highlighted your own experience, Andy, in terms of what you've witnessed and seen. I find then we will be kindred souls in this discussion, because you'll be able to say firsthand or chime in.
Yeah.
And what I witness is what I experience myself. First and foremost, the stages of grief. You can go through that as an organization, particularly if it's with a company you have strongly identified with, that you loved, you know. And I always confess up front, as a former marketing executive, if you've helped build the identity for that company, the nomenclature, the coloring, the email signature, you know, all of that, and then suddenly you don't know what it's turning into. You don't know if the identity is going to stay the same, if it'll disappear, and now suddenly you're going to be a new name. So in the beginning, it can be enormously destabilizing. And I would also say up front that for me, the stages of grief, the first time I experienced it was when Navtech, which was a digital map maker, was acquired by Nokia that you referenced in my intro. And I didn't know what to expect. So these emotions of denial and anger and bargaining were a surprise to me. We're not used to that in business, right? I was an executive. So you're used to, you set objectives, you've got strategies, you move forward. So I'd say first and foremost, and this came through even in the interviews. For my book, I did 3 years of research, spoke with over 60 executives, and consistently they all shared their own stories of what they observed and what they experienced themselves. So stages of grief, I'd say, is first and foremost. The second one that surprised me was the changes in personality. People who you thought you knew can act in very different ways when they are uncertain of their future. And I say in my talks now with executives and at conferences, you just need to look at what happened during COVID if you need a reference point. You probably saw people who you thought you knew really well, friends and family, act in ways that you never expected because they were uncertain of the future. So those are the two things, Andy, that I would say stand out that I write about in my book, and that also as a M&A whisperer that I work on a lot with senior executives.
You talk about the different stages of grief and the anger. It sort of brings back memories for me. You know, I talked about my experience of having worked with clients who've been through this. If you go way back in my career, I was actually involved in a probably much smaller scale, not really a merger acquisition, but rather the company I worked for won a contract that had previously been held by another company. And, mm-hmm. and there's a British employment law called TUPE. I don't know if you got anything similar in the US. It's called it's transfer of undertakings. I can't remember what the P and the E stand for. But basically, if a different company wins a contract, they inherit a contract's employees.
Wow.
So our competitors' employees were running the contract, and now it was my job to run it. But they couldn't make those employees redundant. But they wanted their man, i.e. me, to go in to run the contract. And so I came into an office which was previously run under another company. Everyone in this organization, this office, were suddenly found themselves employed by someone completely different, a competitor, yes. A different brand, with me coming in, working supposedly in tandem with their manager, even to the point of having to share the car. Because there was one car for the manager on that contract. And of course, even though...
Ouch!
I came in after all of this had happened, and even though it's not relevant to me, I had to work like crazy to build relationships with that team because they hated me the second I walked in the door.
Yeah, I have no doubt.
And it's those emotions we're talking about. It's not rational. I mean, some people might say it's rational to hate me when I walk through the door. I hope not. But it's based on a loyalty to a brand that actually you might up and join the competitor the next week anyway. So how do you manage those situations? What would you say to someone like who is in my position, who goes in to manage a team that has felt they've got the rough end of the merger, so to speak, or the acquisition, who feel like they're working now for a brand that they're previously been competing against, who haven't had a say in the stakes and are feeling angry about it?
Well, you, Andy, you actually did what I would recommend. First and foremost, you have to be patient. You have to understand that it's not personal. It's not you. It could have been anyone who walked into that position. So, and it sounds like you recognize that, right? You realized, oh, okay, they're not mad at Andy per se. They're mad at the situation. And the fact that secondly, you also recognized, and you can't speak to them rationally, right? You can't say, okay, chaps, you know, like here's the objectives we've got to go. So you have to be patient, recognize that they are dealing with emotions that they have to get through, and you have to build relationships. You have to prove yourself, prove your worth, prove that you wish to work with them, that you are in it with them together, that you're sensitive to how they feel. But at the same time, you've got a job to do. They have a job to do. And the longer that takes, the less successful you will be in achieving the task. So you did a great job. I would have counseled you to do the same. But you're right. It's the relationship piece. You've got to build those and recognize you need to work hard to build them.
I don't know how much of me was speaking with hindsight and how I actually handled it back in the day in my mid-20s. I think I might have a good few years of experience behind me analyzing that situation when I talk about it now.
Don't we sound smart in hindsight, though? So smart.
Absolutely. If I could have my time again, I'd probably make a lot of the same mistakes and some more as well. So let's take that situation, but look at it from slightly different angles. So I was going to say that that's a slightly different scenario, because in that case, it was not a merger or acquisition, but a contract that was won by a competitor and they were shifted across to it unwittingly. But actually, a lot of acquisitions are hostile anyway. A lot of mergers are. And even if they're not hostile at a senior management level, they might be at a mid-management or more junior level. So what can the leaders of both parties in that scenario do to ensure that positivity flows across all parties from day one?
It's really hard. As you were talking, Andy, I was thinking about one. So I used to, when I worked in advertising, I worked on Coors beer. Yeah. I know you all would never drink it over there. you with your Guinness. But and Coors was merged together with Miller. They were fierce competitors when I worked on advertising, and I still think they don't get along. I think it's an impossible hurdle when you've had two major organizations, companies, brands that were neck and neck fighting with each other for the number two spot after Budweiser. I'm speaking about the American market.
Yeah.
But what I try to do when I am in a position and I've been brought in and you've got leadership merging together is come to the table with respect for the other side. It has to start with respect. And I use the analogy of when you have seen marriages that seem to really be strong, both partners, what you witness, there's love, but above love, there's respect. And they can be very different. The partners can be different, but they bring the best out in each other. They complement each other in that regard, and they bring the best out in each other. So when I paint that for leadership, oftentimes what I see is it allows them to put their emotions aside and allows them to see, yeah, this isn't going to be successful unless we start with respect and we value what each of us brings to this partnership.
There's sort of two sides to this that from my perspective. One is it's really interesting. It's not surprising when you really analyze it, but we're talking about companies in a similar sector. We're talking about the tribal nature of competition between companies. It's almost like they're sports teams.
Absolutely.
And supporting a sports team isn't rational, I know, as a big football fan. And you know, I look at the rivalry with the two fiercest local rivals to my team, and I can't stand them. I can't stand them. And it's totally irrational, and I know that. And I try and fight that, but it feels ingrained. That's a choice in my leisure life, and you create a community there and so forth. So what I'm saying is it seems irrational at first, but you build it. You could have easily ended up working at that competitor. You ended up working at this company, so you feel tribal about it. It's not rational, but we are stuck there. But actually, it's similar. People have similar feelings about their employer, particularly if they're there for a long time.
They do. I've given you advice, Andy, but what I would say is, prior to some of these mergers or acquisitions, had the CEOs asked me, I would have advised them, this isn't going to work. This isn't going to work. You have been such fierce competitors in the marketplace. There are so many instances in particular where a merger and acquisition makes sense because you've got a product that's on the high end of the market and now you're going to acquire the low end. But in the marketplace, the salespeople, the ones who worked on the high end product have said, oh, no, you never want to buy that low end product, right? Let's say it's a light bulb. You know, you are high end light fixtures and they're low end. And then the low end people have been saying, oh, why would you ever want those high-end light fixtures, right? When you can have more of our type of light fixtures. And now you bring them together. You say, oh, we've got a portfolio. We have every kind of light fixture you want. Yeah. Without recognizing that people who have been trying to sell your products, building your products, have been maniacally focused on positioning that in the marketplace as the best version. You know, so it doesn't, it's very hard to overcome that.
So you're talking there about salespeople and obviously your background's in marketing where you are deliberately positioning yourself against that competition. And actually by then selling that competition, you could be painted as a hypocrite. Do you get the same level of tribalism behind the scenes?
Absolutely.
So where does that stem from? Where does that come from?
Well, because, I was describing salespeople, but the same will happen with product and marketing.
Yeah.
Right. They've been maniacally focused. If they're a good company, right, focused on delivering that type of product. So now you're trying to combine everyone together and have them all, you know, sing kumbaya.
Yeah.
It is. I love the fact that you're using the word tribalism. I hadn't thought of it that way, but it is true. I talked about identity, right? You've identified with this company. And the tough part is that's what you want in your organization. You want people to be fiercely loyal to their product, their brand. So now when you mix them all together and say, what's the problem? It's just business. You're thinking, well, it may be just business to you, but I've poured my heart and soul into making this product, marketing the product, selling the product. And letting that go is not something that can happen overnight.
And that leads me on to the second, because I said there were two sides of what you'd painted. And it leads me on to the second because, and by the way, identity and tribalism, identity has to be a core part of tribalism. You identify with your tribe. So
yes.
the two really fit together. And I think the more rational side of the challenge is that you have been focused on our way of doing things, the cause way of doing things, the Nokia approach. When you have that merger of two organizations, when you bring two teams together, you can't operate on both ways of doing things if they are different. You have to find the right one.
And absolutely.
If you pick one over the other, then you're going to breed resentment in people who've invested their heart and soul in coming up with an approach that they favor. How do you address that?
Well, first, I love the fact that you say the right one, the right way, right? So then the issue is, well, whose way is the right way?
Yeah, completely.
And there's a story that I share in my book. It was actually it stemmed from Navtech Nokia, our time together. If you look up what happened, it didn't go well. But
okay,
I won't belabor that on our conversation here. But we were B2B. You know, Navtech had been selling B2B, business to business, and Nokia was B2C, business to consumer. So I would say already culturally there, two very different mindsets, very different. And for us, and when I say us, I'm thinking from my Navtech side at the moment, we spend an inordinate amount of time trying to explain, well, here's how you do B2B and this is why we do it. And, you know, if I were honest, there were a number of conversations where our product guys were saying, this is how you do B2B. Right? Like you valued us at $9 billion. So we must have done something right. You know? And it's the story that I have in my book that I think just helps crystallize it is when we were trying to integrate teams together, and each side felt that their approach was best. And it was a junior product manager who piped up and said, we're fighting over turf, right? We're fighting over who does it best. We need to step back and think, what's best for the customer? How do we get to the solution that's best for the customer? And when you keep your customer as your North Star and work back from what's really best for them, you can let go of whose approach is best. It allows you to just see what you're fighting for. That's the same approach that I use with leadership, right? Work back from what's best for the customer.
Andy's new book, Just Ask, Why Seeking Support is Your Greatest Strength, is out now. Looking at the importance of asking for help and admitting vulnerability, it is an essential read in challenging times. Order your copy from Amazon and all good book retailers now, or visit andylapata.com/justask.
I think that makes a lot of sense, and it echoes with more than one conversation I've had on the Connected Leadership podcast. I'm thinking about a recent podcast, particularly with LaTonya Kilpatrick at Colgate-Palmolive, and we were talking about partnerships. And, you know, she said that ultimately when you're trying to forge a partnership with someone, you have to understand what your outcome is, what that other person needs. And right. When you understand that, it makes a difference. And when you're customer focused, then that has to be the customer and what's going to be the impact for them. So we talked a little bit about how you try and communicate some positivity when you're leading a merger or acquisition. Who controls the narrative about the change? Is it always top led? Is there a point at which the conversation needs to be led from the rump of where the action is, the implementers, the lower tiers? You mentioned it was a junior person who talked about we need to be thinking about what's right for the customer. So how important is that top-down communication about what's happening? And at what stage do you open up to the whole company? Because obviously that can work both ways.
Well, I love the fact that you picked up on my recognizing it was a junior person.
Yeah.
Because I will say to senior leadership, if the communication relies solely on you, this is doomed. We need to bring in the frontline leaders, who I like to call the people who aren't in the room when the deal is made, but who are burdened with the execution. Because if they aren't communicating this and they aren't demonstrating a belief in it, you will not get buy-in. Your organization will look at senior leadership and say, well, of course you think this is fabulous. You've got extra zeros now on your paycheck while I've got more work. And if there's been any redundancy initiative, you know, people are being let go. Not only do they fear they've got more work, but now they're fearful for their job. So if it's only communicated from senior leadership, so the work that I do with executives is to help bring on board your frontline leaders as quickly as possible into that communication narrative, because everyone owns the narrative.
Yeah.
The mistake I've seen is oftentimes they think, well, we'll just have comms and marketing and HR figure it out and then just give me the script.
Yeah.
To which I always say that's not going to work either.
So once you open that narrative to lower tiers of management and you enter into wider conversations, you know, you have town halls to talk about what's going to be happening and so forth. As we've already established, there's a lot of negativity and uncertainty around potential mergers or acquisitions. How do you manage, how do you allow the questions and the uncertainty to be aired? Because if you stifle it, then people
you
just
can't.
Get frustrated. And how do you turn that negativity into positivity and leave people feeling heard and listened to?
So first, what I do, and I will confess it's from my communications background, I do with my senior leadership, this is particularly when I've had the opportunity to work in the due diligence, right? So this is before the announcement. And we'll do a pre-mortem. So pre-mortem is, you know, the deal is done. And then I'll say, what are all the ways that this can go sideways? And you work through the communications. Because I'll say, when you have that town hall, you need to be prepared for all the negative baggage attached to M&A. Everyone's going to come at you. They're not going to be joyful. They are not going to be skipping down the hallway. They're going to come at this, and you can never say, well, let me answer that offline, right? I don't have an answer for that. You have to be as transparent as possible if you want buy-in quickly. And you're not going to get buy-in at that first town hall. It takes time for people to think, okay, maybe this is a good thing. So I intentionally do that pre-mortem to prepare them for the communications and so that they have answers or at least an idea of how they would answer it, because they've got to be transparent in that session.
I had to laugh because I interviewed yesterday, and it, yesterday as in when we're talking now, Daniela Landhoes, who's ex-Google, for the podcast. So that episode will have come out on the 27th of February. And Daniela and I talked about pre-mortems at some length. So if anyone hasn't heard that episode and is wondering what a pre-mortem is, just go to the Daniela Landhoes episode and we talk about it at length.
Well, so, look, I'm a marketer too, so I'm helping you highlight other podcasts.
Totally,
as well.
Totally. But I just laugh because I find it's not necessarily a phrase you hear that often, that frequently, and then to hear it twice in 2 days is unusual. So
But Andy, just since we are on it, you can understand why it's such an invaluable technique for a merger and acquisition, right?
And that's what I was going to come on to. I think that pre-arming yourself, understanding what the conversation is going to be, but not necessarily preempting. I think there is a difference between planning for and preparing responses. Because if you over prepare, people aren't going to feel listened to, are they?
Absolutely.
There's another podcast that I'll episode that I'll point people to, and I can't be as organized as have the dates on this one. I interviewed Kevin Gaskell, the former managing director of Porsche and BMW, a couple of times on the Connected Leadership podcast.
How the hell did I get on?
I'm very selective, and you're showing exactly why. But Kevin, I think in the first time I interviewed him, Kevin tells a story about when he took over a failing shipbuilding company or boat building company. And there was a lot of antipathy towards the management in this company. And it was really failing. And he and his team went in and they went and talked to the staff there about what their issues were, what their challenges were, what they were angry about. And they just listened. Mm-hmm. And then they went away and they worked through the night. And when the employees came in the next morning, they were still there and they said, right, we listened to you and this is what we're going to do. Bang, bang, bang. And they just knocked their employees sideways because they didn't expect a response that quick or one where they'd listen to that degree. And I share that story because I think it's the difference between wargaming, which is what a pre-mortem effectively is from my understanding, wargaming what might come up and being equipped to deal with whatever comes up and over planning so that you're preparing your answers and it's not actually what someone's asked you.
No. So, and that's why I'm really glad you highlight that, because in the pre-mortem, it's not about sketching out here are all my answers. It's being prepared for all types of questions. And then answering genuinely, answering transparently. And I love that example that you gave. That is absolutely what led to his success, by listening to your employees and respecting the comments that they made. Because really, at the end of the day, that's what employees want. They want to be valued and respected.
Well, this quality of respect has come up a few times in this conversation now. So I'm guessing that that's probably one of the most important principles for you in building the trust with employees, both within the existing company and the new company you're bringing on board.
It is the most. If people ask me, what's one piece of advice, if you could only give one piece of advice, come to the table with respect for the other side. That includes the other company. That includes your employees. people will see right through if you don't respect what they bring to the initiative, to the endeavor, to the mission at hand.
So let me ask you this then, because I have spent so many hours over the years interviewing people and discussing and writing about elements that go into building trust. I don't think I've ever had that conversation about the elements that go into building respect. So how would you, an alien lands on the planet and you say, if you want to win over the human race, you have to show that that you respect them. The alien looks at you and says, I have no idea what you mean, but aren't you impressed with my command of English? How do you teach, what do you advise that alien to do to show respect sincerely?
I love that this is an alien scenario. So one of the exercises, I just actually had the privilege of presenting to a company that's gone through a number of acquisitions. And one of the exercises I do is to help people understand culture, to adapt another culture. And so the exercise is called Think Like a Tourist. So Andy, if I were to assume you are an alien, I would say to you, think like a tourist. You are a tourist to our country. When you think like a tourist and you're going to another country, let's say I'm going to France, right? When I've had the most amazing trips, it's when I spend time prior to that trip learning about the country. I learn about its history. I learn about its culture. I learn about its language and its people. And then when I go to the country, and I'm speaking as an American, I don't go to the French and say, well, you know, that's not how we do it in the US, right? I stay open and curious and learning. And then ideally, if the French people who I'm meeting say, oh, you are so open and curious, let me tell you more about my culture, then they will even be receptive to me saying, oh, but here's some interesting ways that we do that also in the US. So for you, Andy, as my alien, I would say thinking like a tourist, because culture, when you think about it from a country standpoint, and then you apply that same type of philosophy to a company culture, understanding another company's culture and staying open and curious and non-judgmental, it allows you to build respect and trust. So I love that you've tied the two together, because I do believe that they go hand in hand.
And reflecting back again on my conversation with Daniela Landher, she talked about an LQ. I had a little laugh with her about this, because I said, we're going to be running out of letters of the alphabet to attach to Q soon. But LQ is a learning quotient. But I loved what she said after that. She said, try to always be learning something new rather than being the smartest person in the room. I may not be quoting exactly, but that was the sentiment. And I think that goes to what you're saying. Always be a tourist is about learning, about accepting you don't know, about questioning and being curious and understanding, and then moving towards a consensus.
Right, but that's so funny that you've had the conversation with her recently, that you know, we're hitting on the same points. Gaining respect is being open and curious and wanting to learn and staying in that mode.
I love that. So you mentioned that you look at culture, and there's obviously company culture, but there's also national cultures and generational cultures and so forth. Are there cultural differences in the way people respond to this type of change?
No. I guess if it would be my first answer, the data that I use for that is, one, when I interviewed CEOs, it was global. So I interviewed CEOs from the United States, from Europe, from Asia, from South America. And what led me to conclude that it's common, you know, there might be some differences culturally in terms of how organizations react, right? In Asia, they may not be as vocal as they might be, you know, in Europe or in America. You know, you may not be aware, but quietly, you know, they're undermining the success of the deal on their own. But the fact is, it's human nature. change, how people react to change and uncertainty is human nature. It's why I use the COVID example of when you think back about how people reacted, it was universal. People were afraid. And how that presented, you know, people acted in ways you wouldn't have expected. So it's not distinguished by country per se, because it's human nature. It's our, okay, our emotional reaction.
I want to finish by going back into the post-merger acquisition environment and some of those issues that might come up at a team level. Would you say that, and I guess in some ways I'm thinking about my own experience that I shared when I was parachuted into the contract, would you say that internal competition is higher in a post-merger or acquisition company and collaboration is lower than it might be elsewhere?
Yes and no. Because competition goes both ways. You will have people who are competing for jobs, right? So their competition ratchets up. People, particularly if they aren't uncertain if their job is secure, and in all of the acquisitions I experienced myself, it was clear that you had to re-interview for your job, even if that was never formally articulated, right? So you feel compelled to show your worth. The non-competition that you're referring to me, is what shows up is it's, you know, I think the term nowadays is quiet quitting, right? You have people hold back.
Yeah.
They want to see how things are going to play out. That they won't necessarily collaborate because they aren't sure if you're going to take their job if they collaborate too much, and the vision hasn't been painted in a way that they understand where things are going and how they can contribute, so they hold back. So my answer, yes and no, is because you can see elevated levels of competition for people wanting to keep their job, and then lack of competition where people just hold back.
Well, let's look at that. That issue of people who have to reapply for their jobs, the uncertainty about what's going to happen in terms of layoffs, the duplication of roles, which, you know, I talked about, I experienced as well. I started by sharing that I'd spoken at various conferences at various stages of this process. And probably the biggest impact that I see when I come into a conference where there has been some kind of change of this nature, often I'm brought in when most of the layoffs have happened. So there might be some uncertainty still there, but generally people mm-hmm. that are left are in their role, but still morale is low.
Absolutely.
They've seen people lose their jobs. So A, why is that when people now know they should be safe? And B, what do you do to manage morale throughout that uncertainty process?
Well, it's interesting you bring that up, because I wrote about that in Harvard Business Review, right? After the merger, avoid us versus them thinking. And that us versus them thinking happens in three ways. We assume it's our company versus their company, but there's also executive versus frontline leaders. Yeah. You and I talked about that at the beginning. And then the third dynamic is who stays versus who goes. That is equally us versus them thinking. And what happens is, and again, I'm always trying to prepare leadership for this, people experience survivor's guilt. Why do I have a job? Particularly if they feel that some of the people who were let go, who they've worked with for years, why was Joseph let go and I'm still here? So they are uncertain. There's their own level of uncertainty. Why did I get to say? Why did I live? Why am I still on the boat? You know? And so you have to be aware of that. In fact, at a conference I just spoke at 2 days ago, that was exactly the case. Everyone had re-interviewed for their job, but, you know, 50% of the group had been let go. They wanted both sides to have to interview, but, you know, they were losing friends. So I was presenting to an audience that, yes, while they had their job, there was still this worry that, well, what if we have to go through this again? What if, you know, another company is acquired? Do I have to re-interview again? It's a bit PTSD. So I'm really glad you raised that, because with leadership, I'll say in particular, you have to be aware that you can say all these positive things, But mergers and acquisition has negative baggage attached to it. So everyone assumes every worst case scenario that's ever going to happen. So even if you say, you know, that's it, you're good, there's always going to be a little inkling that it's not. So you need to walk the talk. You need to demonstrate that, you know, we're moving forward. Here's how we go. Because people will experience survivor's guilt.
Jennifer, so many golden nuggets there. I think it is, as you say, it's always going to have that negative baggage attached to it. We're always going to have, if you're involved in that scenario, where at whatever level, you're always going to have challenges with the teams that you lead, the people around you. You've given some really good insights into how to manage that and get through it much stronger. So thank you very much for joining me on the Connected Leadership Podcast.
Thank you. It was a privilege to be on.
So thanks again to Jennifer for joining me. It just goes to show you sometimes just the right LinkedIn profile, and I just think there's a guest here, and I'm delighted Jennifer joined me. There was a lot to take from that. I particularly like the focus on respect that was threaded throughout the conversation, and this idea of taking the tourist mindset and just being curious and understanding and not rushing to communicate the answers, but just learn first. And it does tie in with the interview with Daniela that I talked about as well. But it is a point. I respect is so important. I talk about it a lot, but I've never given it the time that I've given to trust. So if you have any ideas on that, let me know. Any thoughts, any feedback, any stories about mergers and acquisitions, let us know. I will have been sharing a couple of points from this podcast on LinkedIn and Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. So Jennifer will be tagged on those. So come and share your stories there and engage with us there, as well as please share this podcast with people who might be going through a merger or acquisition and might benefit from Jennifer's insights. And whatever you do, come and join me again soon on another episode of the Connected Leadership Podcast.
Thank you for listening to the Connected Leadership Podcast. If you found this valuable, please subscribe, tell your colleagues and friends, share on social media, and post a review on the podcast channel you use to listen to it. And of course, join us again soon for another interesting interview and great connected leadership tips.